The Guardian. Football Weekly.
Voice of sanity in a sport gone a bit strange. It's Football Weekly Extra. Today, the latest from the world of football, from the cosmos to the championship. Shock transfer news. Bent star plays for the other side. Darren's transfer makes him a villain for Sunderland fans too. Elsewhere, FA Cup news. Arsenal go to Elland back. And why Kevin McCarra didn't bother. Hullet's move to Grozny. Will it be a rude awakening or Chechny football? We get Sid's view on Barcelona getting beaten. The latest from Italy with Paolo. We hear your posts and we look forward to the weekend in the Premier League. All of that in today's Football Weekly Extra. In the pod today, John Ashdown.
Hello.
Hi, John. Paolo Bandini.
Hello.
And fresh back from his sofa, Kevin McCarra.
Just waking up. Hello, James.
Hi, Kevin. And yes, I mentioned your trip to the sofa for the delights of Leeds Arsenal. Why weren't you there, Kevin?
It was a personal thing. No, it wasn't a personal thing. David Coyne was guilty of some authoritative and responsible reporting in The Guardian by asking who owns Leeds United. And that's a very offensive question, it would seem. And it led to The Guardian being banned, a situation that applies even now.
This was a couple of years ago, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But Ken Bates...
But there's a lot of fuss being made of it in today's paper. I mean, why we weren't there, etc.
Yeah, well, this may be because Leeds haven't been there, as it were, on the top level for a while. So there hasn't been all that many occasions to go and cover Leeds. And, of course, this was a big match.
Mm. Yeah, that's definitely the reason. It wasn't that David disgraced himself in the press room buffet or anything.
I can't comment on that.
Oh, all right, then. It was a big game, as you say. First of all, Arsenal's performance. What did you make of it?
Well, I think when you look at the difficulties had this season, that their best centre half's not played Vermaelen and now needs surgery. Goalkeeping chopping and changing. Fabregas a bit tired after the World Cup, then missed a month with a hamstring problem. I think in these circumstances they put together a good team and should get better in the remaining months. To me, Samir Nasri is a player who's kind of stepped up and taken up a prominent role when it was needed. Of course, he scored last night. So, yeah, I think Arsenal have done really well in the circumstances. They could have complained about the number of difficulties they've had through the spine of the team. I mean, Van Persie's another one who was injured, and yet they're in contention for everything.
Bound for silverware, do you think, Paolo?
I don't know about the FA Cup. I mean, obviously, you know, most of the big teams are still involved in the FA Cup, and I think it's pretty early starts getting overexcited. I mean, the problem is, of course, every time you know you get a win like this, even in a game against a team who, whilst they played very well, are a team from a lower division, suddenly everyone's going, oh, look, Arsenal are going to win all four trophies. And you're thinking, well, they're not top of the league. They've got a lot of rounds to go in the FA Cup. They're playing Barcelona in the Champions League. You know, I mean, the one which they should... most immediately be targeting is the Carling Cup, and actually they're losing in the first leg of that. So there's a long way to go. I think there's a lot of positives to take from last night's game for Arsenal, but I think there's always a need to not get ahead of ourselves.
Any positives for Leeds?
Well, I thought they played very well again. I mean, I think it was unfortunate for Leeds to concede so early in the game. I think that sort of really took the sting out of... actually, to be fair, it didn't quieten the crowd down at all at Elland Road. It seemed like they were absolutely rocking, even after conceding that goal. But I think it just it very much changed the template of the game. And you think about the first match and how they were able to just stay with Arsenal in the first half, and then that gave them an opportunity to then really rock them in the second. And, you know, Nasri opening it so early, that gave them something. And obviously, I thought Sanya was doing very well against Parker down the right. And obviously, before he even scored, he'd put that one right across the face of goal that Bentner hadn't stuck in. So, you know, I think Arsenal just, they obviously they had a few more of their first team players in. They raised the game a little bit. But I think Leeds still were a credit to themselves most of the game. And the way they sort of came back and pressed Arsenal after scoring was very impressive. I thought Housen was fantastic again. I thought Gradle did a very good job of pushing on the defence as well.
Leeds could be playing in the Premier League next year. With that team, would they be able to mix it up with the big boys?
Well, Blackpool have proved that you know teams don't have too much to fear when they're coming up, but they need huge investment. I think one of the negatives for Arsenal from last night was the continual disintegration of Andre Arshavin's form. He came to the Premier League as this sort of light-footed, dancing pixie, spanking goals in and going past defenders, and has now sort of got the air of a sort of disgruntled gnome.
They could easily leave him out, couldn't they? I mean, if need be. I mean, it's not as if they like alternatives. I was going to say, the other thing about Leeds was, watching the game from my special perspective, what a fantastic atmosphere. It made you think, wouldn't it be good if Leeds were back in the Premier League again?
And we could actually go and see them.
Well, I don't know if that's possible, but it's a concept.
Could The Guardian not just go along
along in a kind of pair of comedy.
Well, I did this years ago. I was one time banned from a Scottish football ground and I went into the terracing. And this guy beside said to me, "Are you one of the banned journalists, Jimmy?"
What gave it away?
The notepad. Yes. The fact I didn't know what was happening.
Right.
I think Arshavin obviously wasn't great last night. I think there was that moment where he managed to knock one right over the south stand that was really seemed to sum up how he's played in recent weeks. But I do think sometimes at Arsenal there's been a tendency to get sort of stuck in these discourses sometimes. And I think that actually, if you look at last night, Arshavin actually might not have been brilliant all night, but he actually did have some nice touches. And he effectively set up the first goal. I know Shamak had to make that step over it for it to get to Nasri probably. But at the same time, you know, he wasn't totally uninvolved last night. I thought he did do some good things. He probably isn't in their strongest 11 right now. You'd probably have Walcott and Nasri wide with Fabregas through the middle. And I think there's a tendency to blame one player too much. There's a tendency to hail one player too much as being either the whole solution or the whole problem when it really isn't that
straightforward. Can I just check, did Shamak step over the ball or miss it? Can you just confirm that for me?
From a tactical point of view, isn't the problem with Arshavin that he's a player in the throes of an existentialist crisis, playing for a club in the throes of an existentialist crisis? Wouldn't he just be better off at a more straightforward outfit? I'm not sure. I did also want to ask, Kevin, what's the difference between, you know, beyond the obvious Balti pies and that, but what's the difference for you watching a game on telly and being there?
You felt distance from it, I suppose. Obviously, quite literally distance from it, hundreds of miles. But I don't know, something about being there and the noise and other people walking around.
You had replays. You had a lot of advantages.
Well, absolutely. But I you do feel a bit detached.
Thompson's adverts.
I think the issue with TV sometimes is the replays can be a massive advantage, but equally, you're getting what you're being shown. And sometimes, actually, from a tactical point of view, you can see different things when you can see the whole pitch yourself than if you're just seeing what the camera is focused on.
Although, well, I must say, by the way, often in the press box you can get replays on TV too. I mean, they have television and press boxes.
You don't have the option of doing what I did last night, which was turning over at half time and missing out on the ITV's analysis and watching a bit of Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade.
All right.
Missed about 20 minutes of the second half.
Which bit was it?
Well, I just wanted to wait for the bit where he throws the Nazi out of the blimp and says, no ticket. And then everybody starts waving their ticket. And once I got to that, I was back over to the football. Yeah.
An enjoyable film, very disappointing ending, I felt. But hey, that was just me. Now, Arsenal will be hosting Wigan this weekend. Big game there. Wigan with an excellent record away to Arsenal. They've lost all five appearances, only scored three goals there ever. In other weekend Premier League news, Aston Villa are hosting Man City. Now, Man City's 4-0 against Villa not so long ago was regarded as pretty much their best performance of the season, wasn't it? They now have Edin Dzeko in their ranks, but Villa have Darren Bent. Woof. Kevin, you're actually going to this
game. I am indeed, yes.
Are you actually going to go?
I'm trying to get banned, but they seem to have accepted my application. It's very irritating. But no, I certainly am going, yes, at tea time on Saturday. There's that initial shock when you think, Darren Bent's gone where for how much? But just actually looking at his figures for Sunderland, 32 goals in 58 games. No wonder that they want him.
Only two players in the Premier League, etc., Drogba and who's the other one? Rooney, is it, have performed better than him in terms of goals per game?
Certainly, Rooney hasn't done it recently, has he? Yeah. It's won an open player season for Man United for Wayne Rooney. Anyway, different matter. But yeah, I mean, it's what you wonder is when this money is spent, does it mean that Fabio Capello will now start thinking more highly of him as the transfer market reflects his importance?
Well, as you say, there was a huge outcry about this for various different reasons. Even these headlines about betrayal, etc., from Steve Bruce, Bingo the Dog, saying Steve Bruce having a pop at Darren Bent. Would this be the same Steve Bruce that has managed seven clubs in 12 years? Next thing we'll know, he'll be mocking Alex Reid for having a funny, swollen face. Several people posting in Debaser 92 and taunts reckoning that Sunderland should effectively take the money and run for the hills, whooping in delight. Who will this be a good deal for, and who won't it be, or will it be a good deal for everyone?
It strikes me as a good deal for everyone, really, particularly for Darren Bent, who's, as he doubled his money, he's certainly got an increase on his wages and a chunk of the old transfer fee. It makes sense for Villa because it's something they absolutely desperately needed, a proper goal scorer. It makes sense for Sunderland because it's a big chunk of cash they can use on strengthening other areas of the team. Although at first glance it looks bonkers, I think it probably is a fairly sensible deal.
Don't you think it's kind of crocodile tears from Sunderland? They paid $10 million up front for him, and they're getting $18 million up front for him. Is that such bad business? I don't know. I think.
What about Spurs? Do they not get $6 million of this?
The entire first instalment goes to Spurs. Initially Sunderland won't see any of it, but of course they'll know it's coming. Do you know what surprised me almost? Because obviously, I feel like I was aware that Bent's goal scoring record was pretty much what Kevin just said. But I think I'd almost forgotten is that he's only 26, which is yeah. He's actually almost still got a few more years than I thought he did left in him playing that.
He's almost 27, but you're right. Yeah,
My initial reaction when I saw it was £24 million for Bent. Hang on, it was only €24 million for Ibrahimovic. Spread over 3 years or something as well. And I know people in England have their doubts about Ibrahimovic, but at the end of the day, he's won his last 7 domestic titles wherever he's been. Yeah. So that's,
what about Cavani? How much did he cost?
Oh, I don't know exactly, but it's something about £16 million or so.
Yeah, much less than this. What about the game anyway? Bent, you'd expect to be featuring in this match, no? And as I say, City absolutely hammered Villa at Eastlands. It's interesting how City in the last couple of games have become almost the opposite of the stereotype about them. They're full of flair up front, but rather fragile at the back. And again, this 4-2 in their replay, their FA Cup replay with Leicester, evidence of that.
Yeah, I think when they defended better, it's been more to do with De Jong and Barry and people like that. I don't think the defence on paper doesn't seem all that classy, considering no matter how much money they've spent.
I thought a bit much was made of that after the Arsenal game. Oh, didn't Manchester City, came and got the draw they took to make. I mean, at the end of the day, Arsenal hit the post a couple of times and Hart had to make a couple of very good saves. I think I don't believe yet that Mancini has built this solid defensive unit, and I think there are still problems. I think players like Lescott, I'm still not convinced that really he's that great a player.
I think they defend well, it's because they get back in numbers. It's not because the back four is particularly brilliant. But it's been interesting to watch Man City and see that Mancini's original idea was, let's make them boring and start from there. Then we can try and begin again and begin to introduce some creativity, which he is now trying to do with Dzeko and so on. But clearly, he's just a traditional start with the foundations and worry about the rest later.
What do you think about Villa's chances, though, in this game?
Well, they're bottom of the form table, aren't they? They're having a nightmare time of late. I think it's 1-8. And it's a game that City... I tend to find myself saying this a lot, but it's a game that City really, really ought to win if they've got realistic aspirations of the title. I don't think a draw at somewhere like Villa Park at the moment is good enough.
Really? Of course, Villa were trying to save money a bit on wages and so on when Martin Neil left. But now, in desperation, they have to go and pay top dollar for Darren Bent. In the end, it's hard to avoid spending money, isn't it? Mm.
Mm. And they're in again for Charlie Adam, upping their offer to a massive $4 million. You'd feel a bit miffed, would you not, if you were Charlie Adam? You hear that they're just about stretching it to $4 million.
Six Charlie Adams is one Darren Bent.
Yeah, it's quite a thought. Andy Sinton's quiff says, do you think Villa really need Bent, given that they've already got Carew and Heskey? Carew, of course, is on the way out, but he continues. And do Spurs really need Luis Suarez, given that they've already got Gomez and Cudicini? Honk. Another surprising bit of transfer news, though, of course, was the PNR to Spurs. Both Spurs and Chelsea had offers accepted by Everton, yes, and he chose Spurs over Chelsea. Hmm.
Isn't that a bit money, no?
Do you think they just offered him more wages?
Well, it wasn't. I don't know, but Chelsea certainly are trying to be a bit more of an austerity programme by their standards, aren't they? They don't go to the absolute crazy limit anymore.
There's a time when you might have looked at it and thought, oh, well, he's going to look at Tottenham and think, oh, I'll get more games there than I would at Chelsea. But actually, Tottenham's midfield's pretty packed right now. I don't know that he will.
Hmm. Nor do I. Oh, we'll talk more about Tottenham, their game at Newcastle, of course, this weekend, and the rest of the weekend fixtures later on. In a second or two, though, we turn our thoughts to Ruud Gullit. Now, so many things to raise the eyebrow this week. One of the most surprising has to be the return of Ruud Gullit to management, and not only to management, but management in previously war-ravaged Chechnya. An 18-month deal, I think. But anyway, let's find out a little bit more about that by having joined us, Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan.
James.
Hi there. So many questions, Jonathan. Thanks for joining us, first of all.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Where are you, disembodied voice?
I'm in the British newspaper library in Colindale in North London.
We were wondering, Jonathan, whether you're there to check things out or if you're acting as a resource for the public.
No, I'm researching Nottingham newspapers from the mid-80s.
Of course you are. Why, Jonathan?
I'm doing a biography of Brian Clough, which should be out for Christmas. So any old relative you can't think of a present for, my biography of Brian Clough.
Jonathan, we called you up. Well, there's another thing I wanted to talk to you about as well, but the main reason right now is this Chechenian team that Ruud Gullit has joined. Their last manager managed a month there, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I mean, it's obviously a very difficult club with a very difficult owner. The owner is Ramzan Kadyrov, who is the president of Chechnya. He replaced his father, Ahmad, in 2004 when he was killed in a bomb attack on a military parade. The club is actually named after Ahmad Kadyrov. And it's part of this general process of normalization in Grozny, in Chechnya, or Chechnya, that for the Russian state, from a propaganda point of view, it just looks better if you have a football club in a city, if the city's behaving in a relatively normal manner, that it sort of distracts people from the fact there's this horrific war going on, and there are still various threats of terror attacks and whatever. But I think actually also it goes slightly beyond that the propaganda is actually part of the necessary process, that the best way to get people to act normally is to pretend everything is normal. So the club was, it was disbanded during the war in 1995. It was reformed in 2001, started then in the regional leagues in Russia. There's one promotion back up through the levels. They won the cup in 2004, I think about a month after the bomb attack that killed Ahmad Kadyrov, which raised eyebrows. And really, eyebrows have remained raised ever since. There's all kinds of allegations of match fixing going on. The Russian Football Union has censured the club and fined them about the intimidation of referees. I mean, irrespective of the locale and what else is going on in the city, it's a very difficult club to be involved with.
No, careful. We don't want to get banned from going to their games as well.
Can I ask you a question? Brass tacks, how much money is involved in luring Ruud Gullit there, do you reckon?
Lots.
Yes. Yes. Can you guess for me?
Not really, no. I mean, I would say several million dollars probably. Right. Yeah.
Are they a decent team? I mean, is there any kind of logic to this from Ruud Gullit? You can understand why they would want to bring in a big name, but what's the rationale beyond just massive amounts of money for Ruud Gullit, or is it really that?
I'm not sure there is one. I mean, there's various conflicting stories as to what's expected of him next season. Some people say top five, some people say top eight.
I should say, there's also reports we've got here, Jonathan, that apparently the team are after one of the 10 best strikers in the world who is currently playing in the Premier League. Are there any ideas who that might be?
I have no idea who that is, but I did see that statement. It's not new for them to make sort of grandiose statements like that. And I think it's all part of this process of pumping themselves up and saying, yes, we're a proper serious team, we can compete with the big Moscow clubs. I think it's all part of this idea that Grozny is on the way back, that the rebuilding is going on both literally and metaphorically after the war.
All right, Jonathan. Listen, that's fantastic. Thanks for filling us in on that. But I don't want to let you go without asking whether, as per your article yesterday on The Guardian's excellent website, you might think that Sunderland might be better off without their top scorer of the last couple of seasons.
I think that's a slightly harsh way of putting it, but I think for the money involved, I think this figure, 24 million, is accurate, and I think it's a very good deal for Sunderland. I mean, obviously, they've got to invest the money properly. And their transfer record over the last few years, I mean, even since Steve Bruce arrived, hasn't been perfect. But it's probably generally more positive than negative. But there's an obvious need for a striker to replace Bent, because Jan's the only fit striker they have at the moment, with Fraser Campbell being injured, with Welbeck being out for up to 6 weeks after exploratory surgery on his knee. And I think longer term, there's need of probably a winger, somebody with a bit of pace in the team, and probably a central midfielder as well.
All right, then. Quite a shopping list. But do you think the money's going to be invested, or is it all part of the black hole that Roy Keane left behind, as some posters have suggested?
Oh, no, I think it will be invested. I think the new owners have been pretty good about making funds available within reason. I think Sunderland's management, Sunderland's husbandry, has actually been pretty good for quite a while. And I think Bob Murray gets a lot of flack as chairman. I think he was actually pretty good at just kind of keeping things on the straight and narrow.
Excellent. Jonathan, listen, back you go to the miners' strike, and enjoy, and we look forward to speaking to you soon.
Absolutely. Cheers.
Thanks, Jonathan. What a way to spend your day off. Hey. Magnificent stuff there from Jonathan Wilson. In other legend makes apparently random move news, how about that Cantona to Cosmos business? They don't even have a football team, but they've got Eric Cantona.
It's an interesting position, isn't it, to be director of soccer when you don't have any players to direct or particularly a club to be in charge of. It's slightly strange. It smacks of not publicity for the team. They're trying to get back in the MLS.
Yeah.
And I guess they imagine if they get enough high-profile names on board. I think Kobe Jones is involved in some way as well. So
GB Heron is your man, stroke woman. correspondent. He's your correspondent. GB Heron posting in late on Wednesday saying, I know it's dull to talk about American football, but then he launched into this rather nice little paragraph or two about what's going on at Cosmos. And apparently they've got the wink from the commissioner of the MLS that they are going to be the 20th and possibly final team in the league, because the league are very keen to have two teams in New York. New York Red Bulls are actually in New Jersey, but they want to have a bit of a derby thing going on there. He lists some of the people. Pele, of course, the honorary president. Kobe Jones, as you mentioned. Giorgio Canalia played for the Cosmos and at Lazio, and is now still wanted for all sorts of very naughty financial dealings in Italy. Giorgio, if you've settled that issue with the Italian police, my apologies, but as far as I know, that's still preventing you from setting foot in the peninsula. Who else? Former Tottenham vice chairman Paul Kelmsley, Terry Byrne, David Beckham's long-time agent, and Rick Parry of Liverpool CEO fame. So, extraordinary. They've got a kit deal. They just don't have a team to wear it. They've got a nice website, and there's a kind of shop there that's not open yet and stuff. But yeah,
that's it. Natural, doesn't it? The Cosmos should come back. I mean, it's a great city for football, isn't it? New York.
Is it?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's all those different communities. There's huge football roots. It's amazing that they cease to exist in a way.
Although they haven't existed for 25 years, they're still the biggest name in American
football.
Yeah,
you think
football,
of, isn't it? Yeah, Pele and all that. Yeah.
All right then, Paolo. A little bit of Italian news from the midweek, hey? Inter continue to close in.
Yeah, down to 6 points the gap now. They still have a game in hand. Not entirely convincing against Cesena. They managed to go 2-0 up and then took their foot off the proverbial pedal. But they were never in too much trouble. I mean, I think, it was one of those situations where even when Cesena came back to 2-0, you sort of thought, well, Inter are still going to win this. And they were back in front before half-time through Kivu. So it never really sort of felt like it was that much on tenterhooks. Although whenever you have Marco Materazzi starting at centre-back, there's always a little bit of ambiguity.
Mm. But with Milito back, there's a breezy insouciance about them up front now under Leonardo.
Yeah, Milito, exactly. I mean, he's back and back in form, or, most crucially, because at the beginning of the season he was playing. He just wasn't playing very well. I've had sort of, because obviously when I was on recently, we were talking about this, and I've had some people sort of say, well, you were very positive about Leonardo, he's not much of a manager. And I don't know that he is much of a manager, but he is what Inter need. I don't think he's the long-term solution there, but I think he's very much, as you say, he's made things light, he's made it breezy, where before under Benitez, things were very, there was a very cold atmosphere around the club, and everyone was just a bit too weighed down. It just feels like now everyone's just enjoying playing again. And at the end of the day, the squad is still probably the best in Serie A. Mm. So,
you say long term. It's interesting that the reports continue to emanate from Milan and Madrid that Mourinho certainly enjoys talking up Inter as a future prospect, possibly with Leonardo, his chum, as assistant or manager.
Well, Leonardo's basically always said, and this was one of the reasons why Milan were cheesed off when he joined Inter, he's always basically said since leaving Milan, actually, I don't know if I want to be a football manager, I want to be a director. That's really where I see my future. And I think that the assumption is that sooner or later that's where he'll end up at Inter, whether it's this summer or if it's a while down the line. But I think I think some of the Mourinho talk is possibly a little bit pie in the sky. I mean, I think he loves to keep his hand in with all his old clubs. He's always very positive about Chelsea when he was at Inter, even though things ended there acrimoniously. And I think he likes to have the fans and his old players on side with him and keep that door open. And sure, if things go terribly at Real Madrid and Inter were willing to offer him a big wage pack, I'm sure he wouldn't say no again. But
I feel like week to week, though, the league will be more stimulating for him than Serie A.
Not really, because at the moment, La Liga, I suppose he has what might be stimulating is that he has to win absolutely every week in La Liga.
But you're playing Barca
You're playing Barca twice a season, whereas
competing with them, that's the level you're trying to.
Sure, but in Italy, what you have at the moment is. A league in which you actually have three or four teams who could genuinely win the title rather than two, and actually several teams below that who can beat Inter on any given weekend. Which, from what I can see, I have to be honest, I don't see as much Spanish football. I don't see that much Spanish football at all, to be honest. But certainly the reputation that league has at the moment is that you've got two teams pretty much just strolling through everyone, and then twice a season they meet and the games are fantastic to watch. But what is there for him to do the rest of the year?
But there are lots of small nations that are not. Italy's not small, but lots of nations are competitive. It doesn't necessarily mean it's an exciting standard. It could be mediocrity.
Well, it can't be that bad a standard if he took the team to the treble last year.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm just talking about currently, would you say they're the same level? Or?
Well, I don't think that there is any team in Serie A right now that is that is quite on a par with Barcelona or Real Madrid. Having said that, they're not so far behind because Inter did beat them last year and they weren't far off in talent.
But you don't think it's more of a one-off? That's Inter's first European Cup since when?
If Inter played Barcelona even last season with Mourinho, if they played them, you know, 10 times, probably Barcelona would have won 7 of them, and you know, they might have drawn 2 and Inter would have won 1. But at the end of the day, I don't think we're talking about such a fantastic gulf, and I think it depends what his ambitions are. Now, obviously, his ambition at the moment is to win the Spanish League, and I think that is something that he's very much driven by. But if things weren't to work out at Real Madrid, he wouldn't have a lot of choices left in Spain for a start. I mean, once you've been to Real Madrid and it hasn't worked out, where else do you go?
And Barca aren't keen to have him back.
No, so he might come to England at that point. I certainly wouldn't rule that out. And, you know, there's obviously this continuing talk that he could yet be the manager of Manchester United when Ferguson goes. Who knows? But I think really it's England, Italy, and Spain, and who knows? Maybe I suppose Germany. But really, I think it's England, Italy, and Spain, and those are his three main choices at the moment. So why not Inter if it wasn't to be Spain?
But you kind of wonder if he'd want to stick there for a while until he gets the better of Barcelona, which probably won't happen this season.
That's quite the point. Probably won't happen this season. But yeah. I guess there's two questions there. One of which is, you know, will he want to stay? And the other one is, if he can't get the better of Barcelona, how long will Real Madrid keep him around? Because they don't exactly have a history of
Valdano,
patience.
Now, a quick mention for Roma, who beat Lazio yet again, and they go through to play Juventus in the quarterfinals of the Coppa Italia. And was there something you wanted to add on that, Paolo?
I mean, there's some slightly questionable penalty incidents. I mean, the first penalty for Roma, I think, was probably it was one of those.
There's a lot of ill feeling as well. There was a Lazio fan stabbed in the buttocks, and poor old Mancini was the general manager, long-serving general manager, the man who had to put up with Paul Gascoigne and somehow get him to training every day back in the early 90s. Got hit by a shattered windscreen after Roma fans threw rocks at the Lazio team bus. All very unfortunate.
Just on the stuff on the pitch, I mean, Ranieri has now got a quite phenomenal record in the derbies for Roma. I think he's won 4 out of 4. I'm not sure if he's his last 4. You know, for a man who continues to get a lot of stick from Roma fans,
and players,
I think he's in such an unfortunate position there, because I don't think any manager could walk into that situation and cope with the fact that you've got Francesco Totti, who is bigger than the club,
and Adriano, who's bigger than the club,
Adriano, who's physically bigger than the club, and then you've got two other very deserving strikers in Borriello and Vucinic, both of whom playing better than Totti, who deserve to be in the starting lineup probably every week, and actually manage all of that and come away with it. And also massive expectations from the fans after, in part because Ranieri did such a fantastic job with them last season. So I think it's a tough job. And I don't know if he'll last to the end of the season there, because it's so much grief. But it'll be interesting, especially if the new owners come in.
Yeah, new owners. Yeah. Well, that's where we will put a lid on part two. In part three, very shortly, Championship news. Sid and our preview of the weekend's action.
Football Weekly Extra on guardian.co.uk.
Well, now it's time for our regional football league segment, as is traditional in every pod. John Ashton, there's all sorts of things to talk about.
Well, the big game this weekend is, of course, Derby Forest, the big East Midlands.
Have you got anything more southern than that?
And eastern, maybe, as well.
Yeah. No, all western, all western. But anyway, tell us about Derby Nottingham Forest.
Derby currently managed by Nigel Clough. Brian Clough's son, obviously, and he's under a huge amount of pressure at Pride Park at the moment.
They're not doing that badly.
Well, I think in a way he can blame the good start that they had. In the middle of November, they spent, I think, 4 weeks in about fourth spot, and everything was all sun and light, and everything was going very, very well, playing well. But I don't think at the start of the season that any fans particularly expected to be challenging for the playoffs. I think that a season of slow progression would have been fine, but having had a taste of life at the top, I think the recent lack of form, I think they've gone, it's 1-8. They're now down in 14th, and playoffs are looking a distant memory, and relegation perhaps more likely. He's also irritated fans by sticking to playing players out of position, playing only one up front. And they take on a Forest side this weekend, which is always a hugely feisty encounter, with Forest flying under Billy Davis.
Has there ever been a son of a great manager who has also been a great manager? I can't think of
Darren Ferguson.
Well, possibly.
Maybe in the future.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. So often you get sons of footballers being footballers, but rarely sons of managers.
Yeah.
I bet people, like, the posters will know loads of people.
Tell us, posters. Tell us. He drops for glory, says, what the bleeding hell do Southampton have to do to get a mention? Put a Premier League team out of the FA Cup, sack Alan Pardew, produce two off-pod-discussed Premier League wunderkinds, do very well in League One. He goes on for some length. We will tackle the whole Southampton issue, one very close to my heart. When they play Man United, hey, in the fourth round, Paolo, you're looking at me with ill-disguised disgust.
No, I was just thinking, as you know, as our BBC South expert, yep, you should be right up your...
Interestingly enough, on the whole Southampton, BBC South, etc., apparently, I'm not sure if we should believe this, but apparently, sitting on the obligatory red sofa in said show next Monday will be Harry Redknapp. He'll be the guest. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Yeah. Good. If you have any questions, post them in here, and then when he fails to turn up, I can bin him. Now, Sid Lowe, on the line from Spain.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm well, Sid, and how are you?
I'm not too bad, yeah, not too bad at all.
Wife well?
Very well.
Dog well?
Dog's well. She was barking like mad, but she's stopped now, hopefully permanently.
All right. Speaking of Barca, close. How about that? Barcelona lost yesterday.
How about it? They lost. Leo Messi missed a penalty. They weren't very good. I suppose, in a way, it doesn't matter in basic terms because they were 5-0 up from the first leg, but they were beaten 3-1 away from home. It's the first time they've lost away from home all season. It was their first defeat. I think I'm right in saying that it ended a run of 28 successive games without being defeated. And they were beaten 3-1, which is pretty unusual as well, because when Barcelona have been beaten before, I think I'm right in saying that when they lost to Inter 3-1 in the Champions League last year, it was the very first time that Pep Guardiola had lost any game by more than one goal. And they were beaten by a second division side. Has to be said, a very, very good second division side. Real Betis, who we were saying the other day, are on their way back up, and I think everyone's looking forward to seeing them again.
All right, then. United said you wrote a lovely piece in the Sports Illustrated website about the Liga TV deal. Have they finally settled that, then?
No, they haven't, but the deal is on the table and the clubs have agreed to it. It still needs to be ratified because it's still some way off. I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head exactly when the deal needs to be nailed down, but I think we've still got at least 18 months for it. And it's something that's being argued over, particularly by Sevilla and Villarreal, who see themselves as the big losers in this because they just get lumped in with the other clubs. And it's a TV deal that will enshrine the current inequality in La Liga, which it will give more than a third of the overall money to Madrid and Barcelona alone, leaving the rest of the clubs basically knowing that they'll never win the league again.
Madness, Sid. Turkey's voting
madness,
for Christmas.
But logical at the same time, if you see what I mean, because, of course, Madrid and Barcelona are very, very well aware of their economic power. Hmm. And their argument is, well, you try and have a league without us then.
I just want to say, I mean, that's, you know, fair enough, you try and have a league without us, but if they had a league without anyone else, it would be a bit boring.
Isn't that the situation?
Well, this is exactly it. It's the flip side of the same argument. And this is what Sevilla and Villarreal are trying to say. They're saying, they're trying to reinforce this mentality of saying, well, okay, yeah, well, we'll go and have a league without you, actually. You see where you play then. You know, go and try and play in Portugal or in France. And I think this is the question mark, is to what extent can the other clubs, to what extent, first of all, do they care? And to what extent, if they do care, can the other clubs persuade Madrid and Barcelona that they need, in terms of the long-term health of the league, to actually redistribute the wealth a little bit?
Mm. There's no evidence, is there, that there's a fall-off in interest because of the increasing duopolistic nature of the league?
To some extent, there isn't, because bear in mind that Spain is very different to England. Madrid and Barcelona's dominance is absolutely extraordinary compared to England in terms of the fan base, in terms of what they move for TV audience figures. And the relevant Real Madrid or Barcelona game is far, far bigger than any game for any other team, even if it's a big one. So that it's quite difficult to fight against that. But it is true that some fans are turning off a little bit. It is true that ultimately I think there will be problems. We saw a situation earlier this season. I think this is the risk, where Sporting Gijón effectively, they did a Mick McCarthy. They played a youth team, or not a youth team, but they played a whole load of players who weren't regular players, I think seven, against Barcelona, and were accused by Jose Mourinho of having thrown the game. Well, the risk, of course, is that everybody starts doing that.
Yeah, the risk as well is that not so much the fans in Spain, but the fans worldwide lose interest in proceedings over there. There you go. Anyway,
it always amazes me, though, James, that the fans worldwide follow the same thing. The fans worldwide, it seems to me, couldn't give a flying one of those about anyone other than Madrid and Barcelona either. In fact, it always amazes me just how virulent some Madrid and Barcelona fans can be when they in quite a lot of cases, I think, have never been to Madrid or Barcelona.
Yeah, it's quite ironic that we spend our entire segment talking about Madrid and Barcelona every time and then complain about the fact that it's all about Madrid and Barcelona. But anyway, there you go. Sid, we'll speak to you on Monday then, shall we?
So we really are going to end it there with only Madrid and Barcelona.
Was there something else? Is there anything else?
The really big story in Spain. Well, I think it's a big story. Although, yeah. Although you try and make this a big story in Spain. Beyond the fact that Mourinho is an extremely angry man right now, but that would be to take us down the Madrid-Barcelona route again. And the really big story for me is it looks very much like Racing Santander are going to be bought out by an Indian businessman who apparently was one of the people who originally tried to buy Blackburn. So we've got an Indian businessman going in at Racing Santander. We've got Qataris, who are the new owners of Malaga. Mexicans have just taken over the greatest club in Spain, Real Oviedo. And for the first time, we are starting to see that phenomenon that we've seen in England, which is foreign owners coming in and seeing that there might be some value in actually buying Spanish clubs.
Right. Well, it's worked out brilliantly in England, so that's great news for the Liga.
Yes, this is the question mark. But of course, you get into a situation where the amount of money involved is so high that the only people who can possibly afford to do it are those who have enormous fortunes from other businesses.
Excellent. All right. Well, bring us any updates if you can on Monday, and in the meantime, have a super weekend.
I shall try. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sid. Thank you. Sid Lowe in Spain. Now, back in the Premier League, Wolves are taking on Liverpool. Huh. You keep saying 1-8. Liverpool are another of those 1-8. They haven't had a victory yet, John, under that Kenny Dalglish fellow. They're 4 points off the drop. No Steven Gerrard. And Mick McCarthy's side have won 3 of their past 4 at home, including a 1-0 victory over reeling Chelsea earlier this month.
Yeah, I mean, they've got 5 wins at home. I mean, it's away form that's destroying them, but they're a bit of a proposition at Molineux.
Are they gonna have a victory against Liverpool, do you think, Kevin?
Well, I mean, in the end, it seems to come down to players. I mean, there's a tremendous fuss about Kenny Dalglish becoming the manager. Last time he was a manager, it was a few months at Celtic, and he was pretty poor. He's not some sort of magical figure that can make these players different from what they were under Ray Houghton. Ray Houghton. Anyway,
the other one. Yeah.
Roy Hodgson. Good grief. So I don't know. I think the emphasis on Dalglish has been a bit inappropriate. It does seem to come down to football players, and Liverpool don't have enough good ones, and the attempt are making this month to improve the squad are critical to the prospects of what even getting into a Europa League place next season.
Wolves coming off a big win against Doncaster Rovers as well in the FA Cup, 5-0. That'll help them in what seems to be a very cheery time there for Mick McCarthy.
Well, they've gone last 8 games have gone one lose, win lose, win lose, win lose.
That's true, actually.
So they've been a little bit inconsistent.
And it's not that cheery because they're in the bottom 3, I'm now thinking.
Yeah, yeah, so they're not, you know, dancing on the ceiling like no. Lionel Richie or anything.
Are you confident about Wolves' chances at home to Liverpool?
I have a sneaky feeling that Liverpool will win for some reason against all, you know, Liverpool
odds,
hopeless
like
away from
Phil
home.
Collins saying, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. But yeah, that's just a hunch.
Okay. I can't think of any songs about hunches. All right, well, how about Everton West Ham? What about the Grant mess? Could they have handled this any worse, Karen Brady and David Golden Sullivan?
No, you couldn't really, could you? I mean, I always find the whole idea of Martin Neil quite strange because you're asking him to come in January to a club facing relegation and there's some question marks as to whether there's enough funds to improve that squad. So to destabilise Avram Grant, while it being very unlikely you're going to find a major successor, seems to be a really botched job.
And now they issued a statement, we're fully behind him until the end
we couldn't,
of the season.
We couldn't get anyone else.
Yeah. Extraordinary, no? But there you go. And Karen Brady, the story that she tweeted all the players to get them to speak out against Grant so they have a reason to sack him.
Yeah, the whole thing's been astonishing. I would have had a lot of respect for Avram Grant if he'd have turned around and said, you know, after the events of the weekend, and just said, you know what, sod it, I'm off. You can sort it out yourselves. And have left West Ham managerless and in even more disarray. But I suppose his huge payoff would preclude him from doing that.
Yeah, or perhaps his loyalty to the players.
Possibly, yeah. Mm. Well, the players do seem to be behind him. Yeah, no, I think there's maybe one mole, but I think generally the players, well, haven't they scored a goal and ran over to the touchline and jumped on him? Yeah, this season. I'm sure they did that at one point.
Bouncy castle fashion.
maybe if they are, if we have, are they not behind him then? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. I don't think they've got anything against him except that he's not a particularly inspiring manager. Seems to be the consensus from within. But that might be all, you know, Brady-esque tweets. I don't know. Anyway, there you go. But Everton, in the meantime, they're now without, well, Sahar's injured, and they've just sold PNR, and of course Cahill's off in Asia at that exciting Asian Cup business, which I keep forgetting is going on, but he said moving along swiftly. Yeah, perhaps the Toffees there for the taking, although they've had a good run of form.
You were talking about this in the last pod, weren't you? Yeah. Everton, these are the games they don't tend to show up for, unfortunately for them this season. They've tended to show up very well against the you know, in the high profile teams, and these are the sorts of games when they've tended to slip. Whereas, you know, over the last few weeks, I know West Ham have had some bad results too, but they've actually played pretty well in some of these sorts of games. And I think that it's just so tight down there at the bottom. It is ridiculous how many teams there are involved in that relegation race. It only takes one win to sort of lift you up a lot of places all at once. So, But Everton, you know, Everton are in that mix, and they're going to need to start winning, especially at home, games like this. And yeah, they are missing a lot of players. And I think losing PNR is quite a kick, actually, in the middle of the season, to have to take that on top of everything else.
Elsewhere in the weekend, Monday sees Bolton host Chelsea. That'll be a tough game. We might nod to that in Monday's podcast. Blackburn on the Sunday hosting West Brom. Blackpool on Saturday hosting Sunderland, now, of course, without Darren Bent, but we've talked enough about that. Man United at home to Birmingham. Birmingham haven't won there since 1978. Rafael is suspended, of course, following his controversial red card. Is there anything to suggest at that fixture that it won't be another 3 points for the leaders?
Well, Birmingham have won one game away so far this season in the Premier League, so you can't doubt if a second is going to come at Old Trafford.
You do, don't you?
Speaking of clubs embarrassing themselves this week, Birmingham's attempt to sign Robbie Keane this week, or non-attempt, having agreed a fee and announced with great fanfare that the deal was all but done, and then actually getting to speak to the player and finding out what he wanted to
What
be
did
paid.
He want?
Well, more than Birmingham could possibly afford, and or certainly more than they could possibly be willing to pay, which it just seems a very strange way to negotiate a transfer in that you almost announce it as a fait accompli before you've even really discussed the terms properly and found out the details. And they do need a bit more firepower up front, because Zigic hasn't really quite delivered yet, and Jerome's a bit hot and cold. So it's a shame. Well, it's a sort of shame for them, but
shame for Keane as well. No, he'd like to see him play a bit more. No,
Robbie Keane. No, he'd like to see himself play a bit more. I don't think anybody. I think he's his time has gone, basically.
Do you think?
I'll be honest. I think they've dodged a bullet. I think he's. He's well past his best now, Keane. I'm not sure for $6 million he'd represent good value, to be honest. I think this new transfer dynamic. This is what Venkies have brought to the Premier League. We're going to see this be reflected in years to come. That the new method of doing your transfer dealings is just announce loudly in the papers that you want a player and that you're confident he's going to arrive, and then wait for it to happen.
The power of positive thought.
Yeah.
All right. Excellent. Well, there you go. That's it, I think, then, for today's Football Weekly Extra. Many thanks to guest producer Pascal, who'll be joining us on Thursdays, and to you, John Ashdown, Paolo Bandini, and Kevin McCarra. Enjoy your trip this weekend to Villa Park.
I'm leaving my front room.
Excellent.
Especially for the game.
Excellent. And enjoy your weekend as well, listeners. We'll have a European paper review, I think, up for you on Friday, if you like. But otherwise, we'll be back on Monday. So look forward to speaking to you then. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.